Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the newest episode of the Calcioland podcast. So today we have a couple of things for you. We're going to get into the major transfer stories you guys have been asking us a lot about at the top. We're going to answer your Twitter questions on various topics. And then we have two fantastic interviews. First, we have Kyle Martino, former U.S. national team player, who is now a TV analyst for NBC Sports, covers the Premier League. We tied it into Serie A a little bit, and we're going to end it with George Karashi of the Athletic Soccer website. For those of you, and I know many of you love when we cover journalism and writing, I think you'll really enjoy this interview. I know I learned a lot from it. But before we get to all that, I'm joined by our great friend, co-host, Alex Goldberg. So, Alex, this is kind of a hypothetical. You know, I like to ask you hypothetical questions because they lead into good discussions. With Zidane surprisingly leaving at Real Madrid and all the uncertainty going on at Chelsea with the manager position, which we'll get into a little bit more in the podcast, I want to ask you on a complete hypothetical, which one of these two do you think would last longer at Real Madrid between Antonio Conte and Maurizio Sarri?
Oh boy, David, it's a good question, but my answer is going to be very simplistic. I am going to answer this basically solely on style of play. So my answer is Maurizio Sarri would last longer at Real Madrid. When I think about Real Madrid, I think of an offensive team. No matter who their personnel is, I think of a high-powered machine. When I think about Antonio Conte, I think about a defensive manager. I know that's not always been his identity. You've even pointed out he hasn't always been just a defensive manager. But right now he is. And I almost think that Real Madrid and Antonio Conte being together is an oxymoron. So, yes, there might be some other factors. Madrid is a interesting and definitely a hostile place at times for managers or for players. So you can add political parts into it in terms of how would Conte or Sarri handle the media. But once again, I'm answering this strictly on style of play. I think Sarri is a much, much more appropriate fit. So that's my take, David. What about you?
So it's interesting that you mentioned the style of play, and I think there I totally agree. I think Sarri is a much better fit for the style of play, but I think for everything else, I think Conte would last longer in the sense that he knows, the expectations at a big club, and granted, it helps that he has that big buyout clause in his contract with Chelsea that made it harder for him, for them to get rid of him. But I think, Sarri, it would be a culture shock for him to go to Real Madrid. I think even going from Empoli to Napoli was a big jump for him. But Napoli is really such a peculiar place, and he has some family from Naples, has ties to it. I think he fit in really well. As I mentioned to you, with Chelsea, I always thought he'd be an odd fit for a variety of reasons. Maybe in a Latin culture in Spain, that could be maybe a better fit than, say, Chelsea. But I'd be surprised to see how long Sarri could last there. I think Conte would edge him out for a little bit. My gut thinks that, Real Madrid's probably going to go with an internal candidate, but with them, you never know. You mentioned, Conte's defensive approach. I mean, they've had Capello, who is pretty similar to what we've seen in Conte in the last phase of Conte's career at Chelsea. With Sarri, I mean, you'd get really beautiful football. And the other reservation that I have is Real Madrid has huge stars. It takes, Sarri demands that these huge stars get used to his style and play within his framework. So I'm just not sure if those guys would be willing to do it as much as some of the guys that became even bigger stars within the Sarri system. So it's an interesting conundrum. This is really strictly hypothetical. Let's see how the situation with Real Madrid evolves. Now, Alex, the other thing I wanted to ask you about is the situation at Chelsea has evolved a little bit. We have a new candidate in the mix, which is Jokanović. I've seen you've been tweeting a lot about it. So give us our case on why you think he'd be a good fit at Chelsea if he's offered the job.
Yeah, honestly, until you guys reported it, that there was interest, I didn't think a lot about it. But in the back of my mind, I watch Fulham a decent amount this year. Good friend of mine, David, you know him too, Russ Goldman, big Fulham fan. And definitely being a Chelsea fan, I wanted Fulham in the Premier League. So I'm glad they grabbed promotion because they're, of course, rivals with Chelsea. So I kept my eyes on them, and they had a great year. And in comparison to a team like Wolves in the Championship, who were stacked, just like City, they almost, you know, secured promotion so early on in the year. Jokanović did a lot with not nearly as much as some of the other teams in the Championship. His style is something that Chelsea would desperately need. He has a very offensive style. He also is a risk taker. Kind of sounds like Sarri. I'm not saying they play the exact same type of football, but offensive, risk taking. He likes to dominate possession. He's got that beautiful 4-3-3 that everybody seems to want these days. More importantly, there's something about this guy, Jokanović. When I look at him, he just looks like a manager. And that sounds like a superficial, silly answer. But I'm telling you, there's something that you need, that it factor as a manager. And I truly believe Jokanović has it. Now, on the flip side, someone could say to me, oh, but he's coming from the Championship. Get out of here with that crap. Seriously. If you are going, and I'm kind of getting on my soapbox here, David, but if you're going to tell me that you don't want a manager strictly based on where he's coming from, then you don't really care about anybody except for people that you know or people that have long lists of credentials. And I think that is the worst way to hire a manager. At a certain point, every manager had to start somewhere. Yes, sometimes you would like to hire a manager who maybe has proven himself in a higher league, but I'm sorry, that's a silly, silly reason to not want a manager. I think this guy absolutely has it in him to be the Chelsea manager. He did play for Chelsea before. He was not a great Chelsea player. I'm also hearing people not wanting him because he wasn't a good Chelsea player. Get out of here with that crap, too. That's so stupid. Come on. That doesn't correlate at all. And David, one thing for you. You're a big Brad Stevens fan. I heard a lot of people when Brad Stevens was hired, NBA hoop heads, so-called experts, saying they don't want Brad Stevens because he's coming from college. How'd that work out for you? Okay, sometimes you just need to hire a person based on what he can do, not based on what he has or hasn't done, okay? And that, in my opinion, that is Jokanović. I think he could bring a lot to the table. So I'm going to cool off, and we're going to introduce a new segment because we love our Twitter question segment. And since we're now in the transfer window, of course, mainly our Twitter questions are based on transfers. So we figured, since you get so many questions about the same players always, we're going to have this standing transfer update segment. Now, the players or managers in this segment or teams could change, but they're going to be primarily ones that you're constantly asked about. So we can still keep our Twitter questions a little fresh, a little different for each episode, rather than just having our Twitter question segment be about the same three players every episode. So today we are going to start our standing transfer update segment with Milinkovic-Savic. So David, what's the latest on Milinkovic-Savic?
So first of all, man, that was quite the rant from you there, Alex. I think the Daily Express is going to get some multiple articles off that one.
The Daily Star, David. The Daily Star.
So I know you guys keep asking me about Milinkovic-Savic, and, you know, we're not going to post updates on DiMarzio's site if there's really nothing to update. So today, we're recording this on Monday, we saw that Fred to Manchester United is all by official, took the medical today. So if you remember, DiMarzio's first report on Milinkovic-Savic this summer in Manchester United was that they really see Fred as a starter that fits in really well with Matic and Pogba. Everything seems to point to as Pogba is going to stay at Manchester United. So it's going to be interesting to see if Manchester United are going to be willing to spend a very substantial amount. And we know that Lazio is looking for at least 100 million from Milinkovic-Savic to bring in a player who wouldn't be guaranteed a starting spot. Now, I know a lot of people are asking about the Juve side of things. We'll get into it into the questions part of the podcast. I still remain pretty skeptical on the Juve destination for Milinkovic-Savic. But again, I was very surprised when Juve got Higuain and Bernardeschi done, so you never know. I'm also curious to see, while I do think the Premier League probably makes the most sense for Milinkovic-Savic, if there are going to be some other clubs that jump in at the last second. I'm not totally going to rule out Bayern Munich. It looks like they're looking to move a couple of their starting midfielders. Let's see what happens with PSG with financial fair play. And you never know if a Serie A-based manager like Sergio Conte goes to Real Madrid, maybe they'd be interested in bringing him there. So I think Milinkovic-Savic, we're not going to have an immediate resolution anytime soon. So I have a feeling we'll be talking about him for quite some time on the podcast.
All right, David, the next one we're going to tackle. What is the latest on our favorite Alexandro?
Yeah, he's been the OG on this podcast. So I'm going to say basically there's no developments from last week. To me, I don't think there's ever been more momentum for Alexandro to stay at Juve in the past year or so. We all know how his performance dipped last season and how, you know, there were some thoughts that maybe that was because for once Juve wouldn't let a player that wanted to leave go. But you look at Juve's situation right now, Spinazzola, who was supposed to compete for the starting left back role, injured his ACL, is going to be out for a while. Asamoah enters all by but official. I don't think there's much, if any, connection between Darmian and Alexandro, but it looks like Juve and Manchester United are still haggling on the price. So as it stands now, Juve is really, really thin at the left-back position. But again, ultimately, it will also depend if Alexandro wants to sign a new contract. He's not going to World Cup. Maybe he wants to change the scenery, or maybe he decides, you know, I can stay in a system that I'm comfortable with at Juve and try to reestablish my value.
All right, the last one for this segment for this episode, something a little close to my heart. The Chelsea manager, David, what do we got?
So we kind of filled in some of the blanks at the top. I was just thinking with the whole Chelsea situation, Conte's agent, Federico Pastorello, like he really deserves a lot of credit, and I'm sure Chelsea fans don't see it that way, for getting that huge buyout clause in Conte's contract. He used his leverage perfectly. This was after Conte had won the title. You know, it wasn't long ago that we were talking as Conte in the conversation for best manager in the world. So you got to give a lot of credit to his agent for working that in. And I think that is a huge issue in the whole scenario with Chelsea's manager situation. At this moment, Conte is still the manager. It's going to take a lot to pay him off. It doesn't surprise me that the idea of having to pay Conte's clause and Sarri's exit clause before that expired at the end of last month wasn't the best scenario for Chelsea. I still think Sarri could be a factor for Chelsea, but his contract with Napoli is still valid, although Ancelotti has been hired in Italy. You can have multiple managers under contract. I think Chelsea is waiting to see if Sarri can somehow rescind his contract with Napoli. But, you know, if he has to pay Napoli to make that happen, keep in mind, Sarri hasn't been at a top club for a long time. He's not a manager that's made bank in his career. Far from it. So certainly a complex situation. I still think Laurent Blanc is a significant candidate for Chelsea, or maybe they'll go with Jukanovic. And as you were describing his background, it made me think it sounds eerily similar to when Conte arrived at Juve. It was a player at the club, didn't have much of a track record at the club, but had done well in the lower divisions. And then look at how Conte, the job he did at Juve. So I wouldn't ignore that option as well. So we'll keep this segment. You know, again, the protagonist may change, but we have respect for our audience. I know you guys want to keep hearing about this, so my apologies to those who are a little tired out by this. But one thing that I'm not tired of are all the great Twitter questions that we get from you guys. You can send them in using the CalcioLand hashtag. And which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, let's start with this. What's your take on the latest report from the New York Times on Milan's ownership situation?
So I have a couple of thoughts. So first off, we had Tariq Panja, who wrote that article in the New York Times that came out last week, on our podcast before. I want to reiterate, he absolutely does not have an agenda against Milan, would really have no reason to, but I can assure you, let's take that off the equation. I think almost everything he wrote about Milan previously last November, which is why we had him on the podcast, turned out to be completely true. So I think he deserves the benefit of the doubt. And I know a lot of people are upset that he's quoting anonymous sources, but guess what? That's what reporters do almost all the time. I know it's probably much easier to believe an anonymous source or like an anonymous source if they're telling you Bonucci's coming to Milan. I know that might sound crazy, but it is happening, than when you get news like the one that was delivered, which is that basically UEFA is almost certainly going to deny Milan's plan and they're going to be excluded from the Europa League. But, you know, don't shoot the messenger. I think the world of Tariq as a reporter, and I've said it time and time again, the sooner the Elliott Fund takes control of Milan, the best. I don't know much about these owners that they have. I think it's very nebulous where their money is coming from. So the sooner they're out of the equation, the better. They just bring too much uncertainty. I think even the idea that the current owners would bring in a minority partner in the equation sounds a little bit ridiculous to me. Like, I don't know why anyone would want to be a minority partner with these people that don't have their own money, it seems. But again, I've been wrong a lot about Milan. I didn't expect them to close the deal at all. So my final thought, though, too, is I have to say I am amazed at how much Berlusconi is getting a pass on the whole Milan situation. If I had to blame one person for the mess Milan is in, it would be absolutely him. He failed completely to live up to his pledge that he would sell Milan to a group that could make it great again. The fact alone that they needed to get a loan from the Elliott Fund should have told Berlusconi these aren't the people for the club. So, you know, if you want to get pissed at Tariq Panjo people reporting on the situation, maybe redirect your anger to the person that created it.
All right. Next Twitter question, David, what's the latest on Alisson and who could potentially replace him at Roma?
So very intriguing situation with Alisson. You know, we've covered him a lot on the podcast. I think he was not only the best goalkeeper in Serie A last season, has been the best season I've seen a goalkeeper have in Italy in quite some time. Not only is he an amazing shot stopper, he's also has a ball distribution skills that we haven't seen in Serie A for a while. Now, Roma is in a position of strength. If you followed them in years past, usually by June 30th, before their fiscal year closes, they have to sell a lot of players to meet their financial fair play situation. That's why with Salah, they really weren't in a position to hold out for much more money than they received. But this year, they're in a much better position. Like, they'll probably have to sell a minor bench player, someone like Juan Jesus, or a borderline starter like Perotti to kind of meet the financial fair play situations. But then they'll be in a position of strength with Alisson. My gut is that after the World Cup, assuming Alisson does really well, it wouldn't surprise me if a godfather offer comes in and Roma moves him. I think, you know, they look at what was paid for Ederson when Manchester City bought him. I think that was about 40 million euro. I think it's going to take a lot more to get Alisson. So I think if a huge offer comes, it would have to be after the World Cup. In the meantime, it wouldn't surprise me if Roma gives Alisson an extension. That won't mean that he'll stay necessarily. As far as who could replace him, this is really interesting because I think Juve, one of the underrated storylines in them signing Perin, it's not official yet, but that seems like it's going to happen. It's to me, Juve, they also took off a very good option for Roma as a potential replacement for Alisson, and for Napoli, who are desperate for a keeper. So I think, you know, Juve looked at it more, you know, we can get a very good keeper to compete with Szczesny at a reasonable price. But hey, if on top of that, we can also keep him away from our competitors, the better. One name that we've seen linked to Roma as a potential long-term replacement for Alisson is promising Udinese keeper Mere, who played at Spal this season. I'm not sure he's ready to be the starter full-time at Roma, but I could see him being eventually as Alisson's replacement.
All right, staying on goalkeepers, David, where could Thibaut Courtois head next?
So Di Marzio reported that Courtois has failed to reach an agreement with Chelsea. So if they want to make some money on him, this is the summer to do it. He'd like to go back to Spain. Now, Alisson is also a target for Real Madrid. Their top choice is De Gea. If they can't get him, there would be Alisson. But now Chelsea is also interested in Alisson. So we could kind of have a carousel where maybe Courtois goes to Real Madrid and that opens up, you know, Alisson for Chelsea. Then you'd have to ask, where does that leave Liverpool? And maybe they'd look at the goalkeeper on Atletico Madrid, Oblak, who's a great, great player. And for him, PSG is no longer an option because Buffon is going to go there. Hasn't been announced yet. I think it's because of PSG's financial fair play issues, and also because PSG is waiting for the UEFA ruling to see how long of a suspension, if any, Buffon will have. So it's an interesting goalkeeper carousel going on here. And I know, Alex, you've watched a lot Courtois. Would you miss him if he leaves the club?
It entirely depends on his replacement. I mean, he is one of the best goalkeepers in the world. I will never argue that, especially in terms of talent. I don't feel the presence from Courtois that some Chelsea fans do. I don't think he's a bad leader. I just don't regard him as a leader. Some Chelsea fans tell me I'm crazy because he answers to the press every game. To me, that does not define a leader. But if it was Alisson, David, no, I would not miss Courtois. But if it's a significant step down, yeah, I absolutely would, because a great goalkeeper is still something you should never take for granted. So it totally depends on the replacement. So, David, let's move to the next Twitter question. This is a player I've never heard of. Do you expect Paul Pogba to leave Manchester United this summer?
Well, you know, everything that's being reported by my colleagues in Italy is that he is going to stay at Manchester United, and that Mourinho is now focused on getting the most out of him. I think Fred and Matic and Pogba is a trio that seems to players that complement each other well. So as it stands now, I'd be really surprised if he leaves. Now, I know there's been a lot of buzz on him potentially returning to Juve, but because of the enormous cost of what Juve got for him and his huge wages, it would have to be like on kind of the Cuadrado model, so a two-year loan with forced option to buy, something along those lines. I think that's pretty far-fetched that he could return to Juve, especially now because Emre Can is all but official there. So as it stands now, my expectations is Pogba is going to stay put.
All right. Next Twitter question. Could Pjaka be included in a potential deal to bring Milinkovic-Savic to Juventus?
So there's been a lot of buzz on, you know, Juve potentially trying to lower Milinkovic-Savic price by inserting some players. I've seen Pjaka, I've seen Rugani, who makes a lot of sense for Lazio with De Vrij going. But, you know, just look at Juve. When they sold Pogba, they were adamant they wanted it to be a straight cash deal, not players included. Now, the reason clubs do that is it just looks much better on your books if you can, you know, turn a huge profit on a player, especially someone like Milinkovic-Savic that Lazio didn't spend that significantly to buy in the first place, when the difference between what you paid for him, you count the amortized value, and then what comes in for him, it makes such a better financial impact on the club if you do a straight sale. Now, they could be done as separate deals, that Pjaka and Rugani then go to Lazio as completely different deals for accounting purposes, but I'd be a little bit surprised by that. I think Lazio is going to look to cash in on Milinkovic-Savic. They have a sporting director who has a great track record of, you know, getting good players from abroad. So it would surprise me because, again, Juve themselves with Pogba just wanted a straight cash deal, and I would imagine that's Lazio's preference.
All right, how about this? Is there any substance to the Papu Gomez to Lazio rumors?
So Papu Gomez are very, I think maybe not as good as his previous season at Atalanta, but the club Atalanta has been pretty ambitious. Like, they're no longer a team fighting to avoid relegation. They're a team fighting for Europa League spot. So I wonder if he's content with that. Now, Lazio is also in the Europa League, but they are a step up from Atalanta, especially in what they could pay him wages-wise. Lazio have been interested in him in the past. When Kita Balde left, he was looked as the potential replacement, but that was before Luis Alberto completely exploded. My expectation is Luis Alberto is going to stay put. Felipe Anderson, I'm not so sure. So if Felipe Anderson is sold for a big amount, it wouldn't shock me if Lazio goes back to Papu Gomez.
All right, David, let's go to Roma. How close are Roma to completing deals for Berardi and Cristante?
So Roma, again, it goes back to the fact that compared to years past, they're in much better financial shape because of their deep run in the Champions League, and they've been quite aggressive for a while. Cristante coming off a very good season at Atalanta. I still have in the back of my mind that he could be fool's gold because he does so well for Gasperini, a manager that makes players look great. But you can't deny he had a very good season. He comes from a good pedigree. He was a highly rated Milan youth team player. So there's a lot of buzz for Cristante. Juve and Inter are also interested in, but Roma definitely seem to be the early leaders in the race. Now, keep in mind, Roma were also last year with Kessié, and then they ended up losing to Milan, so you never know. So, but as of now, they're the favorites. Berardi as well. To me, this makes a lot of sense because of his close bond with Di Francesco, his manager from Sassuolo. I wonder if Sassuolo is going to be willing to sell both Berardi and Politano. It's certainly possible. So I think, you know, you got to wonder how much Berardi's value has slipped after he's had difficult seasons. But I think his connection to Di Francesco, it makes sense for him to go there. He just has a very peculiar personality. So having a manager that he's familiar with would certainly be a plus.
All right, last Twitter question. David, what can we expect from Di Marzio's website this summer?
So today, for those of you that are familiar with what we've done, to me, this is the unofficial start of the transfer window for us because Di Marzio's TV show, Calcio Mercato L'Originale, restarts tonight. For those of you that have followed me in the summer, we have blitzes of transfer news where we have 8 to 10 stories a night at the same time around 11 p.m. in Italy. The reason we have a blitz of stories is Di Marzio is doing his TV show and he's talking about a lot of stories that we post on the website. So think about it too in those terms when you look at the stories that are posted. Sometimes I've had people ask me, why the hell is he talking about this? And it's like, well, it's because he has a TV show and there's a guest that ties into the story. So we'll definitely have the blitzes of transfer news Monday to Friday, which everyone looks forward to. We have transfer news throughout the day. I'm really excited. This is my 5th summer on Di Marzio's site. I have a lot of gratitude for it. You know, I always believed in myself. I knew the Di Marzio site would give me a lot of exposure for my other work. Like, I bet you a lot of people are listening to this podcast because of my work on Di Marzio's site. But this year, I have a very large team. I have a very dedicated group of guys. So we'll be bringing you the transfer news. I think we're off to a very good start with the reliability. I think you guys are noticing more and more news on the Premier League because we want to give the people what they want. But, of course, the focus is always rightfully going to be on Serie A. So I'm very much looking forward to my 5th summer doing this. I think our podcast is going to fill in the blanks well. We're going to take some of the stories from the Marzio site and expand on them. So we appreciate everyone's support. So with that out of the way, let's get to the fantastic interviews. We're going to start with Kyle Martino, and we're going to get into the Premier League, soccer in the U.S., and his career in broadcasting. So I cannot think of a guest that checks more boxes for what we look for in Calcioland. The only thing missing is really a tie to Serie A, but I'm going to ask him a little bit about that. But we have today the fantastic Kyle Martino. So for those of you not familiar with his resume, he's a former player. He's played for the Italian national team. He's played for 2 MLS teams that have been in the headlines quite a bit, the Columbus Crew and the Los Angeles Galaxy. He's now a TV analyst on NBC where he covers the Premier League. He previously worked for ESPN as well. And he also has ties to the movie business, which I'll have to save for the next time he's on. So, Kyle, it's a real pleasure to have you on. Welcome to Calcioland.
Wow, thanks so much for having me on. One correction, I haven't played for the Italian national team. I played for the U.S., but I do have my Italian passport, so it's not too late.
Ah, there you go. Well, hey, we need help right now on the Italian national team, so I hope you're still
in
shape.
I've got no national team in the World Cup. I mean, it's brutal.
Yeah, well, that makes two of us. So listen, Kyle, I want to get into your career with broadcasting and ask you a little bit about your former teams and MLS. But let's start with some things that might be a little bit more familiar to our listeners. So I'll ask you about two former figures from Serie A who are in the Premier League, which you cover brilliantly on NBC. The coverage on the station is really amazing. So let's go on the assumption that this is it for Conte as Chelsea's manager. I think at this point that's almost certainly going to be the outcome. How do you think he's going to be remembered at the club?
Well, you know, I don't think he's going to be remembered as fondly as he should. I think he's going to be remembered a lot better than Jose will after he left, even though Jose was incredibly successful at that club. His last season was a complete disaster. You can't really say that of this past season with Antonio Conte. Obviously, they lift the FA Cup. Finishing outside of the top four is a disappointment, but when you look at the transfer business or lack of business that they did in the summer. They're a weaker team this season than they were last year, and all the teams around them improved. So this crop of players showed us last time they won the title under Jose Mourinho that they can have a dip, they can have a lapse in concentration and effort. So I really think that Antonio Conte should be remembered in high regard. Don't forget, halfway through the season, his technical director walked away as well. So yeah. The turmoil behind the scenes is the big worry with Chelsea.
Absolutely, and I agree with you. I mean, I'm a huge Conte defender, always has been. I've been disappointed with some of his attitude and a little bit his effort this season, but I completely agree with you overall. His legacy was probably not going to be as good as the contributions he did to the club. So let me ask you about another player we've talked a lot about on the podcast, and this is Paul Pogba. So let me ask you, the way you see it, what's his situation like at Manchester United, and do you think Mourinho has been the right manager to get the most out of his considerable talent?
I think Jose isn't the right type of manager to get the most out of him. He's trying to, and you know, listen, in the past, I guess the devil's advocate is that Jose Mourinho helped Eden Hazard get PFA Player of the Year by being a more disciplined and two-way player. So, you know, I could see the argument that Jose could be the right guy, but I think the divisive, abrasive approach of calling people out publicly, as he's done with Pogba, you know, switching him to a position he's not comfortable with, wanting him to be more defensive-minded, wanting him to sit a bit more, all of that has led to an unhappy player. And Didier Deschamps said it when Paul Pogba was in a national team camp. He's not happy at Manchester United, and Pep Guardiola told us that, you know, a sneaky little provocation. He told us that Mino Raiola, Paul Pogba's agent, had shopped Pogba to Manchester City on the sly in the January transfer window. So I think this is going to be a either he goes or I go situation. And I see Paul Pogba lasting at Manchester United longer than Jose Mourinho.
Very, very interesting. So one last question that I have on the Premier League before we get into the two teams you played for in the United States is on Manchester City. Now, I think for a lot of clubs, there's this obsession with the Champions League. I think for a lot of the top clubs, it feels like almost anything short of winning the Champions League makes the season a disappointment. I think that's a very tough standard because it's only one team can lift that trophy. So let me get your take. You played football. You've covered the league, you know about the world game. How do you rate the Manchester City we saw last season compared to some of the best teams you saw or played against in your life?
Well, I said this a little over halfway through the season and got all sorts of vitriol from the wonderful, loving Twitter crowd. And I said that Manchester City is the best Premier League team we've ever seen. Now you have to qualify that and say there's a difference between greatest and the best. No team has ever won the Premier League for sure and a First Division league, because I mean obviously professional soccer in the First Division in England goes way back beyond the 90s, but those dominant Liverpool teams, the great Arsenal Invincibles, some great Jose Chelsea teams, you know, the Manchester United treble winning teams, none of those teams ever won the Premier League in as dominant and as aesthetically beautiful way as Manchester City just did. I mean, they absolutely steamrolled the division and did it with a style that everyone said last year Pep couldn't win the Premier League with. So I think there's a bit of a revisionist history. That treble-winning team, as amazing as they were, Bayern Munich absolutely crushed them in the Champions League final, and they found a way to win, which was miraculous and makes them great. The FA Cup semifinal, Dennis Bergkamp missed a penalty kick to knock them out of the FA Cup, and they won the Premier League by a point. You know, that's great. It's just not dominant. This Manchester City team was as dominant as a Premier League team has ever been.
Very interesting, and I agree with your take there. So now let's talk about let's move to the U.S. Let's talk about two clubs that you played for, because I think they're kind of on the opposite side of the spectrum, but have very interesting storylines. So for some of our listeners that aren't familiar with what's happening with the Columbus Crew, they are a franchise in the MLS, and they almost certainly going to be packing up and leaving Ohio and moving to Austin, Texas. I think for fans of European football, this sounds like such a foreign concept. It's hard to wrap your head around. If you're used to American sports, you know that this has happened in the NFL. It's happened in the NBA. So since you played for the club, and I'm sure you still have ties to what's going on there, what's your take on the whole situation?
Well, first and foremost, it's just sad. It's a really sad situation. For me personally, the club that gave me my dream, that I still have so much love and respect for and still follow, the idea that they won't be around anymore, it's just a really sad situation. And then I take my personal, I think a founding team in Major League Soccer is in jeopardy of going extinct. It's just not the way it should be. And, you know, I understand it's a business and people have to make hard decisions and this is the paradigm that we live in. But when you look at the situation and see that there were parts of the contract when Freeport bought Columbus Crew that said he could move the team to Austin, you know, it just kind of seems like this was the plan all along. And if that's the case, it's just so disrespectful and so awful to this fan base and this franchise that means so much to the Columbus community. So I hope there's some sort of last-ditch Hail Mary that keeps the team there and they can figure something out. It's not looking good, but, you know, this is the ugly side of the way, you know, the sports structure works in our country.
I certainly agree there. So let me ask you another MLS-related question, and then we'll get into what you see is needed and for U.S. soccer as a whole. So there's been a lot of buzz on Zlatan Ibrahimovic's arrival at the LA Galaxy. For people that aren't, you know, familiar with MLS, this kind of fed the narrative that MLS is a retirement league where players like Pirlo, Schweinsteiger come. Now, from my perspective, I'm by no means an MLS expert. I kind of see this as a shame because I see what's going on in Atlanta. I see a lot of MLS clubs, you know, going for younger players and really trying to change this narrative. I think almost all the designated players now in MLS are tend to be younger players. So, of course, you know, you can get Zlatan, there'll always be buzz. But I thought it kind of took away the shine from everything going on in MLS. So let me get your take on the move. And do you think it ultimately even matters what people who aren't that familiar with MLS think about this this transfer?
Yeah, it's a good question. I see both sides of the argument. I mean, for me, it just depends on the scenario. You know, there's this great saying that Sir Matt Busby, the old Manchester United legend manager, said. He said if they're good enough, they're old enough. Meaning young players, it doesn't matter how old they are. If they can play, put them in the team. You know, it's kind of a funny twist on that. The opposite is true. You know, if they're good enough, they're young enough. You know, Zlatan Ibrahimovic, you know, he's got an age that's way up there. And most people will look at that and say that's an expiration date, but he's a freak of nature. The way he takes care of himself off of the field. Don't forget, before he hurt his knee, he was the leading goal scorer for Manchester United and got double-digit goals in the Premier League. I mean, this is a guy that still has tremendous talent. He has bravado. He has off-field presence. And they didn't make a huge financial risk with him. I mean, you know, he's only making like $1.5 million a year. So as far as the risk return, I think that makes sense because he can still play. He scored that incredible goal in his debut game. He creates buzz. A player like Wayne Rooney, on the other hand, that they may have to pay $20 million to get, he may make $7 to $8 million a year. The opportunity cost to buy an aging player that's past his time, even if he's iconic and still a good player, when you think of all the other players that could be bought at a young age or academies that could be funded or infrastructure that could be built with that money, that's a situation where I think you're getting into the territory of this isn't the type of league, you know, Major League Soccer should be still trying to be at this point.
Fantastic. So you kind of hinted, I think, on some of the things that you're looking at with this. So for our listeners that aren't familiar with your career, not only are you a former player and accomplished broadcaster, you actually ran to become the president of the U.S. Federation recently. There was a lot of great candidates. So let me ask you, had you won the election, what would have been the first few things you would have tried to accomplish to further promote soccer in this country?
Well, I would have started with the youth programs right now. I mean, of course, the focus for everyone is the top of the pyramid, you know, hiring a coach, yeah, hiring a GM, hiring a technical director. Of course, you need to do all those things. I think a lot of that's the easy part. The problem with the structure at the top of the pyramid is the U.S. Soccer hasn't created checks and balances. They have two or three people making macro technical decisions they're not qualified to make. So you have to hire the right people to go in there who can create a vision, who can empower some great people within U.S. Soccer and hire the right people. I mean, that honestly seems the easy part to me. The hard part is fixing a completely fractured Hunger Games of a youth landscape where the cost to play is skyrocketing, and Aspen Institute showed us the latest numbers, and participation is down again in our sport. So the cost goes up, the enjoyment's going down, and players are leaving the game in droves at young ages because it's just not as inclusive and not as enjoyable as the game used to be. And we have to get that landscape right. We have to get the largest part of the pyramid right, because that's the funnel up to the national team, but that's also our future fans, our future coaches, our future refs, our future administrators. They're not going to be a future anything in soccer if they fall out of love with it at the age of 10.
Yeah, very, very interesting, and I'm totally with you. I think that's really where the focus needs to be. I mean, you know about the details much more than I, but I'm glad that would have been at the top of your platform. So let's close on this. You know, a lot of our listeners are aspiring journalists. They have YouTube channel. They're writers. They have their podcast. Now, you've been an accomplished broadcaster, and as I was getting ready to interview you, I thought back on when I had Alexi Lalas on the podcast not that long ago, and I asked him about his career in broadcasting, and he made an outstanding point. He goes, look, you know, I have the advantage of being a former player, but, you know, he also said, if you're not good at this, being a former player isn't going to keep you there for a long time, and I certainly think that's absolutely true. So tell us a little bit what advice you'd give to an aspiring broadcaster, and if you could go back to talking to Kyle as he was getting ready to launch this career, what would you tell him to focus on?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think there are two important things. One is find a person or persons that you like their style, you like how they analyze the game, or, you know, if you want to be a host or if you want to be play-by-play, just find someone that you respond to. And like anything, just cherry-pick certain aspects of how they call the game and really be analytical. You know, watch with a critical eye on, you know, whether it's phrasing or when they pause or when they start replays. All those little details just really get lost in trying to figure out why you like listening to that person. And then the next thing is you have to get reps. So someone asked me, a young high school student in my town who wants to be in TV, if I meet him for lunch and answer that question. I did, and one of the things I said is you have to get reps. So I don't care if it's the high school team, college team, whoever will let you call a game, do it and get reps. And if someone won't let you call a game or do an interview or do a recap of a game, turn on a camera, turn on your iPhone, point it at you, do the interview, do the game, do whatever it is, and throw it up on the internet. Put it on YouTube, put it on something, because the other thing you need to do is you got to get rid of that vulnerability and that fear of people seeing you do this job. And I'll tell you, some of my first times on camera, I'm sure they would be very embarrassing if I saw them today. You just have to get out there and do it.
Absolutely. What great advice. Yeah, I'm a big believer in the reps. I like the idea of throwing it up on the internet, but even if no one's listening, there's so much benefit in doing it. So before I let you go, Kylan, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you. Let me ask you, who's your favorite Italian player, or and if you have a team you follow specifically in Italy?
So growing up, there were two teams I followed closely. I followed Milan and I followed Juventus. And one of my favorite players of all time, which this will be one of those name drop stories, but I still have to pinch myself that I've become friends with him. Del Piero is one of my favorite players ever.
Ah.
I was just watching him, and then obviously when Zidane came and Pirlo and all the incredible talent that have come through and wore that 10 jersey, although Zidane was 21, and enjoyed, you know, life in Serie A. I mean, Del Piero was as good as it gets. And one day down by the beach in Venice, we play in this pickup game with a bunch of us washed up ex-pros, and Del Piero came one day, and we struck up a friendship, and I still, to this day, just can't believe I was able to become friends with one of my heroes and a legend of the game. I mean, that guy was incredible.
I'm taking this was Venice, California, right? Not Venice, Italy?
Yeah, no, I haven't made it to Venice, Italy to play yet. No, now, he lives in L.A. now. And
yeah, he's there a lot.
A friend, an Italian restaurant owner brought him to the game one day, and you know, we struck up a friendship, and he still goes and plays, even though I don't live there anymore. Those guys all get together, and every now and then an Italian tourist will be jogging by on the beach and say, that guy looks like Del Piero, and just walk by.
Yeah, I grew up in the same town as him. I used to watch him when he was 12 years old in Padova. But then I remember he's a Lakers fan, and then I realized no one's perfect. So in any event, Kyle, it was an absolute pleasure to have you on. I hope you're willing to come back on. I want to ask you more about broadcasting, a little bit of research. Your connections to the movie business are beyond fascinating as well. So it was a real pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And for those of you interested in journalism and media in general, we have a fantastic guest. I've been trying to get him on for some time. I've been following what The Athletic, which is a very exciting website here in North America, has been doing, covering the classic American sports. And they got into soccer, as we'd call it here in the U.S., football for those of you listening to us outside of the U.S. So I'm thrilled to be joined by the managing editor of The Athletic soccer page, George Qureshi. He's the former editor of What a Howler, has been covering soccer in the U.S. for quite some time. So we're going to, for those of you that are looking to break into this field, I think you'll find this fascinating. So, George, welcome to Calcioland. It's a real pleasure to have you on.
David, thanks. My first trip to Calcioland. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Hopefully the first of many. So as I mentioned to my listeners, I've been following U.S. sports for quite a while. I'm fairly old. I used to always read the newspapers, the sports sections, the Sunday paper with the big sports sections was always something that I really gravitated to. Now, with the changes in the newspapers business, The Athletic kind of filled the void of the classic newspapers in each city. There is a specific Athletic in most U.S. major cities. They also try to make a broader appeal to fans who maybe don't live in the specific city but still want to follow the team. So that's been my first impression of The Athletic. Then I did a bit more research, and this is really a different business model. So instead of going for clicks and trying to get a headline that will get people to click on the article to get the advertisement revenue, The Athletic's going in a completely different model with a subscription base. So tell our listeners how you think this is going to promote better content on a side as opposed to something just trying to grab someone's attention with a headline.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you mentioned the sports page analogy, which I think is actually a really strong analogy for us. You know, back in the day, you could open up the sports page, and if you lived in, you live in Boston, you know that you're going to open it up and see stories that matter to you, and not necessarily have to go searching for those things that you know, you think you're going to be interested in. And so The Athletic is very similar. You open up the app or open up the web page, and once you're signed up, you've given your preferences. They know what sports you like, what teams you like, what leagues you follow, and you're just presented with the stuff that you want to see. And there are journalists covering these teams on a day-to-day basis, doing that, you know, sort of in a sense, old-fashioned legwork reporting that has sort of gone a little bit out of vogue these days.
Yeah.
Of, you know, in the hot take era. And so, you know, you get gamers, you get, but much more than that, you get the backstories on players who, you know, don't necessarily hit the national interest, but are definitely mm-hmm. big stories in local, you know, local markets. So, you know, that's a really compelling offering. And then when they layer over, I think, you know, stuff like the soccer vertical that we're doing, which focuses on, you know, American international soccer, you know, Premier League, La Liga, we're going to be going a little more into, you know, Italian soccer when the season starts again, French soccer, Bundesliga, those big leagues that people really are caring about and watching more and more these days in the United States. You know, you get sort of a great mix of the local and the international that I think is, you know, for me as a soccer fan, really compelling, because I have teams that I like to watch here. I have teams that I like to watch abroad, and finding one place that I can get it all in one place is, you know, I love that.
Absolutely. Very interesting. So as I mentioned, my first experience with The Athletic was reading. They were starting here in Boston. They hired fantastic writers for the Patriots, for the Celtics, the Bruins, the Red Sox. And they kind of took that business model in a lot of different cities. Now, with you're launching the soccer page, and please tell us a little bit more about that, but it seems this is a much broader scope, as you mentioned a little bit already. So tell me a little bit how The Athletic decided to get into soccer coverage, and what can our listeners expect to get on The Athletic?
Well, I mean, one crucial thing, David, that your listeners need to understand is that The Athletic is totally subscription-based. There's no advertising. A, that just makes a really nice, clean reading experience. If you spend some time in the app, you know there's no pop-up videos. There's no sounds coming from, you know, who knows where. You know, there's nothing basically trying to get you to do anything but read the story, which is sort of the point of you know, seeking out these stories, in my opinion. We've taken the approach of just going where the audience wants us to. Like, what do you want to see from us? What do you, you know, you're the ones paying the bills, so you tell us what you want to read. And so we get that data, and we go back and invest it in, you know, covering the things that people want to read about. Now, on the local level, a lot of the cities had launched MLS, you know, coverage already. You know, Seattle, for instance, hired Matt Pence, who was the Daily News' was it Seattle Times, I want to say, is the name of the paper up there. He covered the Sounders for them for 3 years, was laid off. And so we got him now covering that team, just have been a great way to sort of sweep up where local coverage is maybe falling short, and provide something that people want. You know, and so for us, we're looking at, okay, how can we take that really strong local day-to-day coverage and then mix in some of the bigger stories that we didn't necessarily have anyone covering full-time? And so our first full-time writer that we hired is a guy named Paul Tenorio. And he has been, you know, he's been a reporter for the Washington Post, the Orlando Sentinel, 442. And so, you know, we thought we want Paul to be going out and chasing bigger national stories. And we've added to that roster with freelancers in Europe. We've got Graham Hunter, who does covers you know, Spanish soccer really well. I love his podcast as well. And just when I hear him talk, I think, man, they're like, as an editor, I'm thinking, you know, he just spouted off 10 different story ideas that I would love to have him follow up on. You know what I mean? And so I emailed him. I was like, Graham, you like write for me, and I just want to send you. I'll just listen to your podcast. We're gonna be like, hey, write about this, write about that. And so far it's been beautiful. So, you know, we've just gotten a roster of writers who I personally, after 6 years of editing Howler, was either familiar with from working with or had watched for a long time and didn't have like the money to get, for instance. And it's just been an exercise in putting together, you know, a team that I think is really, really compelling, really readable, the people that I would want to read, you know, on a regular basis, which luckily I do, and I get paid for it.
Yeah, and you guys have really a very impressive roster of writers. So this kind of ties into the decision of The Athletic to get into soccer to begin with. So tell me a little bit how you see the sport as a whole growing in the United States. Of course, we don't have the U.S. and the World Cup, but aside from that, I really see so many things on how the sport continues to grow here. I actually really see an opportunity with the fact that what you read about the NFL with concussions, the league as a whole, how it's run. I think the attention span that people have these days isn't really conducive to baseball that much anymore. So where I'm sitting, I see a great opportunity for soccer to grow in the U.S. So tell me your perspective on this subject.
No, I think we're on the same page. I mean, you know, you look at the trends, and I don't think it's a surprise that soccer and basketball are the two sort of sports that I feel like are growing faster than any others. And, you know, one thing, you know, you mentioned the attention span, you mentioned, you know, the health concerns. I think one thing that you didn't mention that you probably feel pretty strongly about, like I do, is the links to international sports. So basketball is growing more and more in the United States, and a lot of that influence is coming from overseas, you know, players who were brought up in other cultures and bring other ways of playing the game. I think soccer has a lot of that as well. And people, you know, people are just, you know, finding that, man, this sport is, you know, I mean, you know how it is. It's you, once you get involved in something, you learn about one thing. And, you know, in the U.S., I think the pattern has been every 4 years, the World Cup, people, it opens their eyes. They see it. They're like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. How do I get my fix without waiting for another 4 years? And so they figure out, okay, I got a local team, or, hey, I can turn on NBC and watch the Premier League, or, you know, whatever it is, there's a way in. And so I think that, you know, people just get sucked down that rabbit hole, and the culture, which I think is an interesting mix of, you know, American made, but also, you know, borrowing heavily from different traditions, whether it's England, Italy, South America, you know, Argentine culture. And they find, oh man, there's a whole community here. I mean, that's my theory about what's going on in Atlanta. You know, if you look at Atlanta, you say, wow, you know, 50, 70,000 people going to a game, that makes no sense. But if you think about the history of soccer, you know, the big industrial cities in Europe, Milan, Barcelona, Munich, Manchester, these were all places where people in the 1800s were going from the villages. They were losing, the connections, the local connections. They were losing their religion in a sense, and they found a community in their soccer clubs. And I think you look at the migration patterns in the U.S., people are flocking to Atlanta in record numbers. And I think what they're finding in Atlanta United is this community that they're missing. It's like a modern day equivalent to what was happening 100 years ago. It's really, really interesting. So, there's a lot of factors, but man, I'm so excited to be involved in American soccer right now. Cause it's been this way for like several decades. Let's admit, it's always looked like it's on the verge of breaking out, but man, it is breaking out. So, you know.
Yeah. Now I think it is too. So, you're at the forefront of this. You're the managing editor of The Athletic Soccer. So for those, again, I hope you guys have a better sense of what a prestigious site this is right now, but honestly, it probably took you a long road to get to this point. So tell our listeners a little bit how you got into sports journalism and what were the milestones along the way that got you to where you are.
Yeah, I would say I had a kind of a non-traditional path. I grew up playing. My dad played in the old NASL, so I was always familiar with soccer. That was never, you know, that was sort of my, that was my game. That was my sport. You know, I was just secondhand, right? Second nature, I guess. And so when I went to college, I was doing a lot of writing. And so I went into editing at magazines, several of which, I guess both magazines I worked at no longer exist, which tells you something about the industry. It was National Geographic Adventure and Condé Nast Portfolio, a business magazine. So I was up in New York. I was working in those magazines. I moved over to books, and I was an editor for HarperCollins for a little while doing nonfiction. And during that time, a friend of mine who was a reporter on, you know, pop culture stuff for the Wall Street Journal quit his job, and he did a Kickstarter campaign to start a video games magazine because that's what he was really passionate about. And he wrote about music and you know, art and film, whatever. But that was what he loved. And I said, you know what, if you can do that for video games, I bet you there's a market for soccer. Because, you know, I mean, my premise was that essentially nobody was really respecting, you know, the big sports pages, I should say, weren't really respecting American soccer fans. You know, they would do one story every 4 years. It was, you know, it was just kind of surface level. And so we did it. We launched Howler as a Kickstarter in 2012 and put out 14 issues. When I was the editor, I just passed it on to a new editor, and they're working on the 15th issue, which I'm really proud that it's going to keep going beyond me. But, you know, that was that's how I got into it. And so I really actually came, I had the background in the game, but I came through the publishing world. And I think, you know, my goal was to make Howler look like a professional magazine, like the ones I had worked on, you know, and get people to pay us for it. And that was the big goal, right? Can this be sustained?
Nowadays, that certainly is a big goal.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but you know what? But ultimately, you get what you pay for, right? So if the quality is good, you have to expect the people have to be compensated to pump out that quality. So as you mentioned, the landscape's changed quite a bit from when you got into journalism. What advice would you give? And a lot of our listeners right now are looking to break into this field. So based on the new landscape, what advice would you give to someone that's who's an up-and-comer in this field?
I mean, here's how I the best thing I can do probably is explain like what I look for in a new writer. Cause you know, I often work with writers who don't, you know, they'll come to me and they say, look, I don't have a lot of clips. You know, I can't show you a lot of work that I've done. But what I've seen from them is like, you know, writing for a blog that like maybe a couple hundred people read, it's not a huge thing. Right. And so I'm looking at that and I'm saying, you know, hey, this person has some talent. I bet they could do it on a, you know, for a more, I guess, in a professional capacity to some extent, you know. And I sort of see something there. And really the two main things that I look for are like an area of expertise. Like, do they know what they're talking about? You know, and that just comes from watching the game, talking about the game, loving it, you know, sort of getting into that, living it the way that, you know, a lot of us do. And the second one is, can they write? I mean, that is I think an overlooked part of this.
Yeah.
Because as an editor, I don't, you know, honestly, I want somebody who has a great sense of story. I want to be taken for a ride here, and I want somebody to know the narrative structure that's going to get me into the story and then keep me reading it throughout. And that's really important. And it's not a skill that I think, you know, that is highly valued these days. You know, I work with a lot of writers, and I'll send them back an edit. I'm like, this is a kind of a stiff edit. Like I gave it to them, you know, like they're going to need to step it up here. And what I hear back, instead of like, oh man, that was brutal, was, thank you so much for editing my thing. Like, I don't get an edit like this anywhere else. And you know, not anywhere else. Like, sometimes I hear, like, there are a couple places that do this, but I really take pride in getting down and dirty with the text and making sure it's the best it can be. And my feedback that I hear from writers all the time is that not a lot of places are doing that these days. It's just that it's too geared toward just turning it out fast and turning to the next thing.
Absolutely. And I think for you, it's got to be hard because sometimes you're the first person really giving feedback to someone on their writing and whatnot. And some people probably take it better than others, but it's really great that you're doing all this. So, George, I can't thank you enough for coming on. I'm very excited with everything going on at The Athletic. Based on the writers that you have and the organization you have, I know it's going to be a huge success. But I wish you best of luck, and I look forward to having you again on CouchLand to talk more about these topics.
David, thanks so much. Can I just tell your listeners where to go if they want to test it out?
Absolutely.
For a week?
Absolutely. Please do.
Awesome. Yeah, so it's a free week's trial and then 33% off for the rest of the year, which puts it at around $3, I think, per month. And so you just go to theathletic.com/soccerexpansion. And if you go check that out, you can also just go to theathletic.com/soccer and sort of take a look at a few of the stories we have there so you can get a taste of it. But yeah, I mean, we'd love to have as many people who want to come over and check it out as possible, and we think you'll be happy with what you see.
Absolutely. Well, George, thanks so much for coming on. It was a real pleasure.
David, thank you.